I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Also, thank you for following us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. This podcast is at the Rugby Dungeon. And of course, there's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast at Rugby Podcast, where you can find me, Tim and Phil ranting about whatever we decide to rant about next. Thank you for all your kind feedback regarding the listener call-in podcast. I think I'm going to do that more often. I think I'm going to open it up to pretty much whoever wants to call in, have a chat about, you know, how bad Leicester Tigers are, or whatever it is that you want to talk about, you can just call me and we can have a good natter about that. Today's natter, though, is with former London Irish head coach, did wonderful things there, doing sterling work at Bath at the moment, an all-round interesting guy. It's Toby Booth. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, I'm all good.
Now, a second time we tried to start this conversation. Where on earth are you?
I'm in Bath. I'm actually at the top of Bath, up by the racecourse. I've been out and about doing a few bits and pieces. We have a down day today. We've had 2 days of training, a rest day, and then we start our sale preparation for a week tomorrow.
Of course, yeah, you're coming up to the AJ Bell. I know you're all professionals and it happens every week, but how draining is it to go through a Bath-Gloucester game, particularly at the Shed, and particularly playing so well in patches too?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've had three derbies in a row. We've basically had Exeter, Bristol and Gloucester, and obviously we appreciate, you know, the extra bit of emotion that these local derbies have in the West Country. But obviously, in critical parts of the game, but critical part of the season, you want to make sure that, you know, you put a run of games together. And, you know, the disappointing thing that we haven't managed to do that, but the encouraging side of that is that we've performed well in patches and, you know, given ourselves chances to win the game. And not many people do that at King's Own. We've got a good record there. It was just disappointing that we couldn't manage the game well enough to apply enough constant pressure.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Bath shortly. But, I thought I'd kick off with this. I don't know if it's a statement or a question. But, you know, interestingly, it sounds like you could have been an electrician, a lecturer, but instead you decided to be a senior coach at one of Europe's most prestigious clubs. Has that roughly summed up what's happened so far?
Yeah, I've done it. It's probably I was a professional rugby player at Blackheath, alongside doing my undergraduate and teaching stuff at St Mary's. But yeah, that's pretty much in a nutshell.
The whole electrician angle, was that just in case this coaching lock didn't quite work out?
No, basically it was about, in the sense, my father works in the construction business. He works in marine steel, and I went to a grammar school, played too much sport, didn't get the qualifications I needed, so it was about out of necessity really, what's the next best thing. At the same time, I was still very committed to sport, which was the reasons that I didn't do as well academically as I did. So I did things the wrong way around, really. I went and basically got a profession and then went back and did my academic stuff a little bit further down the line.
Excellent. So what were your days back in Blackheath like then?
Well, I played in Blackheath. I was born in Folkestone in Kent, right by the closest point to France you can get. So it was basically a football area above anything else. Well, I say football, there was junior rugby, junior football. The closest decent football was probably Gillingham, which was away, and Blackheath was the most prestigious club that was closest. So, you know, I had some success you know, county and divisional stuff, and Blackheath asked me to go along. So, you know, that's how I ended up there. And, you know, I was a one-club man from that point onwards, and spent a long time there captaining the club, which I felt very privileged to do. And played with, you know, people like Mike Friday, etc., and Matty Stewart and people like that, and John Gallagher, and you know, enjoyed my rugby very much. And that gave me the grounding, you know, basically to want to use what I learned there and probably put it into a career where I'd probably underachieved a little bit. So that drove me into sort of, I've always had a love of the game and love coaching because of the responsibility of being a captain, and, you know, that sort of naturally evolved in down the coaching route, really.
Why did you feel that you underachieved?
Oh, just only from an academic point of view, really.
Okay.
And obviously I was pretty committed on the pitch, had a lot of long-term injuries. So, you know, it was almost like I didn't get the opportunity to quite get where I wanted to go. So, you know, talent needs trauma. And that trauma drove me to want to get on and do bigger and better things.
So for you, it was always going to be, after I've hung up my playing boots, I'm going to go into coaching. I'm going to pick up the whistle and go and teach lads how to play.
It wasn't as marked as that. It was probably the fact that at the time, whilst I was still playing, I started coaching the university team that got to a couple of Booster finals. I started involved. I coached England universities, England students on their program. I then obviously had started to, you know, plough a furrow into coaching, and then obviously a natural progression came along after the undergraduate stuff when the England academies came on board. So, you know, it sort of fell into place nicely. Really, the timing was good.
Yeah. So, how did you find your way into the London Irish setup? Because I think that whole London Irish team and what you guys achieved is one. I mean, I think London Irish fans appreciate what you all did, but I don't think it's nearly appreciated enough in wider rugby circles.
Well, I ended up getting there because effectively a friend of mine, a guy called Mark Percival, who basically was from the area, he said that these jobs were coming online, and he made me aware of it. So I applied for the job along with Corin Palmer, who is works for Premier Rugby now. So we became the academy managers at London Irish, and obviously London Irish wasn't financially a massive club, didn't have massive support. He had some good local Irish businessmen that were committed to it. So we were basically tasked with making London Irish sort of a competitive force and develop their own talent to enable us to, you know, to be competitive. And, you know, it was a long-term project, and we saw it was the onset of the academies. So there was quite a lot of uptake quite quickly. Uh-huh. And that's where, you know, we found the likes of Dylan Armitage, Topsy Ojo, Kennedy, you know, they were the sort of Nils Moore. They were the, you know, probably the first entourage of players that we, you know, that we worked with. And, you know, by the time we'd finished all of that, we'd got up to sort of 50% of homegrown talent and became a force in the Premiership rather than just someone that was hanging on for relegation when we got there. So that obviously evolved for me into a senior coaching role. Gary Gold gave me my opportunity to step up from the first team, and particularly from a forwards point of view. And then when he left and Brian Smith took over, he offered me the assistant coach role. So that's basically the progression through Irish. And he left and went to England. I then obviously took over the reins and had four/five years there as head coach. Premiership final, European Challenge Cup final, produced a large amount of international players for the programs that we run. So yeah, I'm very proud of that.
Excellent. So you were literally in the first tranche of academy coaches. This is a brand new thing.
Yeah, it was the first thing. So the academy coaches, which were then England Rugby funded, they basically appointed, it's almost a collaborative thing between the club and the country. I think Wasps went first. I think Wasps were first to go, and we were second, I think. So Alan Powell, Rob Smith took over at Wasps, and they were already in situ, really. And then, but we were a new academy because we did, they didn't have academy, effectively academy coaches, bar, you know, the age grade stuff that they ran. So yeah, everyone then, and that was the onset of the academy system that you see today.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, the academy's been around for a while now, and I'm sure staff go from one club to another, but when you were doing it, I guess you were just inventing that role at the time.
Yeah, and there were lots of teething problems at the start of it, you know, the, you know, simply from the funding point of view, the funding was originally done per head, so everyone went out and got 25 players because that's what they wanted, and you know, there was not enough quality involved, and then it worked out, well, that's not going to work. So, you know, there was a lot of teething problems in logistics and how it was run, but you know, we cut our teeth, and fortunately a lot of good players came out of that. The onset of professional in itself was always going to, you know, mean that we were going to get up and running, and there was going to be an influx of good players. If you think the whole of that, it's funny, I was talking about to someone today about Danny Cipriani. Danny Cipriani, I'd visit Whitgift and be coaching Richard Thorpe and people like that, and I'd see Alan Powell coaching Danny Cipriani in situ at school, and you know, those things sort of, you know, we took for granted at the time. We just went out there and did what we thought was right, and we refined the processes as we want, and, you know, a lot of good players came out of it.
So how did you go about identifying your talent back in those days? Was it lots of watching schoolboy rugby?
Yeah, a lot of that. I mean, obviously, I know you and you watch a lot, and Alex and whatever, and you boys go and, you know, have got your finger on the pulse on a lot of the age grade stuff. It was no different then. You know, there's obviously an eye for talent, a technical bit, as influence of the game. And often, I think people often get drawn to the eye-catching moments, but it's sometimes in certain positions not about the eye, it's what they're not seen to do. So, yeah, there is skill and an art to it, I think, but the more you watch, you know, the more you know what you're looking for, and, you know, the experience comes into it. But it's not an exact science, and what you see in someone at 15 and 16, you know, can completely change. We took the attitude of, okay, we can improve technical ability, but the number one criteria was always going to be attitude and desire. So we took that sort of as our baseline. Mm. And then we'd look at the technical and the we could always apply the tactical side of things. That was the easy part. And the you know, the person you're looking for is, you know, the person that stood out in their peer group, that could do things instinctively, you know, without thinking and without giving it too much thought process repeatedly. And when you asked them the question why they did that, they couldn't tell you the reason why. And those were sort of the, you know, the things where we started with. And then from that we built, well, in this, the positional expertise, this position requires more of this, this position requires more of that. And, you know, we refined it as we went.
Awesome. So just basically picking out the, I think you coaches call it, the unconsciously competent.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. It's exactly that. And, you know, that's probably as true today as it was then.
So going up into the Irish first team then, I mean, would you say that squad, more or less, was a product of, you know, well, you know, you can't compliment yourself too much, but basically, you know, a good crop of youngsters which had been bought through the London Irish Academy?
Yeah, well, we ended up, as I said earlier, 50% homegrown, but you still need a good culture and a good group to show them the way. And we had a lot of, you know, foreign talent that was good. You know, Mapasua sticks to mind, Clark Dermody, people yeah. like that, you know, that were good, that had good experience, brought different things that, you know, that the school system and the county system and the Northern Hemisphere coaches experience, they brought different things. And I think it made them more rounded. And, you know, that if you had the attitude, and, you know, we obviously traded on the fact that, you know, we're viewed as, you know, the new kids on the block, the second-class citizens and the poor me, you know, that becomes quite a potent mix because no one gave us a chance. And, you know, it's always better, well, history would tell you it's much easier to be an underdog, a happy underdog, than a happy favourite.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to interview Glenn Delaney, and it was his view that yeah. if you'd have kept that team together for another couple of years, you probably would have won the thing.
Yeah, I think that at a critical time, you know, that's an easy thing to say. I think, you know, we certainly had enough good players for sure. But the thing about, and you see this in professional sport, you, the mental side of the game requires refreshment. And I don't mean from an often in modern sport, it's about, oh yeah, we need a new coach, we need a new approach, we need to, you know, we need to evolve, we need to, you know, innovation and all these sort of things. But actually, there's great security and great faith and confidence in consistency and, you know, slow progression. But what you do need to do is competition for places to drive the attitudinal thing, which is the number one thing, the ability and the want to do it. So I think, you know, I look at the Premiership final side, that team was probably at its best right then, you know, with a lot of those boys at the prime, sort of 27, 28, those youngsters, so Stefan Armitage, Dylan Armitage, those boys, you know, then kicked on to Toulon and whatever they needed, a new challenge. And we had boys that were like Mapasura, et cetera, and Solossi and those sort of boys that were probably just getting to the top of the hill. So I think that the challenge for selection and having people that were wanting to kick it on, that group had been together for 4 years, 5 years, you know, and you know, your Paul Hodgson's, et cetera, would bring relentless energy, but you still need to drive it forward. So the club, unfortunately, weren't in a position financially to maybe invest in a few more players or change a few more players out. And I think, you know, that we paid the price. That there's always a downside. The impressive thing for like a Saracens is to relentlessly be in the shake-up year on and year out. It takes an enormous amount of energy. And that energy is fueled on the culture you've got, but ultimately the competition that you've got and the drive that you've got. So, you know, that's probably... It's a different time then. People weren't aware of the mental side of the game as much as they are now. And people always talk about mentality and resilience and all these sort of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are more educated about them. Whereas, you know, it was all about, you know, maintaining that effort. And your coaching styles were often around tactics and technical. And as it's always been, and you pay less attention to the mental side, even though you knew it was important. But we weren't educated enough to drive that forward. And the best way to drive it forward is keeping a freshness in your players and your group.
Now you've mentioned culture a few times there. If you were to work with a brand new bunch of boys tomorrow, how do you go about setting up a good culture? What are the things that you do?
If you could answer that in one sentence, you'd be a very wealthy person. Because that, you know, that is the $64 million, you know, the $64 million question. I think it certainly understands that you're part of something. What you're trying to do, and it takes a lot of time. It does, without doubt. It takes a lot of investment of time. It takes a lot of relationship building, and it takes a lot of honest performance conversations. So you have to have a robust environment that's able to take feedback, good and bad. But you have to basically foster a high amount of trust, and energy. And those are probably the three things. So trust, you know, energy are probably the foundations of any culture, because when the pressure comes on, those are the two things that are going to be called into question.
So it's really interesting that you say trust, because I kind of see a bit of a dichotomy here. I do wonder how coaches remain consistent, because some lads really appreciate it when you say, look, I'm going to drop you this week because of this and the other. And the theory would be, that player trusts you now because you've been brutally honest. But I can also see an equally good argument for the coach that goes around to all the players and doesn't tell them that in order to build up their confidence or, you know, to keep them on board. So it must be pretty hard to stay consistent.
I think it all stems, we talk about relationships. So what you're talking about, what we refer to as a performance conversation.
Okay.
So you can't have a performance conversation if you've got no trust. And the trust element is about, understand that we've got a job to do as a team and what we're trying to do, but also I'm trying to make you the best player and support you and look after you and get you on your own personal journey as well. So it's basically keeping a team and an individual's agenda aligned the best you can. Those don't always run true.
Yeah.
But if you understand that you've got a strong enough relationship, a robust enough relationship, you show general care and build trust with people, you can have those less, I suppose, enjoyable parts of development, which is failure and change and bits and pieces, and understand that that's not going to derail you. The moment you feel persecuted and untrusted and don't have worth, those things can get eroded pretty quickly.
So how do you have a performance conversation, and I'm talking about like a critical one here, with a player, you know, say a star fly half who just had a terrible game but relies on his confidence? How do you go about doing that? Because, again, you know, I think it's a pretty difficult thing.
Well, I mean, the way you describe it, you make it sound like it's always, you know, a top-down conversation.
Yeah.
The first thing about it is the player itself has a clear awareness of what's expected and his own standards of performance. So that's always the basis of where you start. So I would say 5% of players, you know, 5 to 10% players max, have no inkling that they're going to be dropped. If they're honest about their performance, they understand their performance, they care about their performance, they're self-critical, they're self-aware, they already know that they've underperformed. But that being said...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're not going to drop someone on a one-off. So again, the care and trust bit's all about conversations that have gone on in the weeks leading up to that. It's not a knee-jerk reaction, and that's where people use the term form. It's about honesty and conversations about trying to make them better, support them. If it's not working, sometimes it's best to take someone out the fire and let them mentally recover, give them a program of work that will give them confidence to get them back on the horse as soon as possible.
Yeah, so you're almost constantly signposting to players throughout the year. It's not going to be a one-off, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. They sort of know it's coming if you've done your job well.
Yeah, I think, well, I'd say no, it's coming. I think they'll be disappointed. They'd hope it's not coming.
Yes.
But the whole thing is, look, we've talked about this. This is not improving. We're not doing this in the right way. Let's just take a breather here, let you mentally recover and put together a program of work to help you get back to being your very best. Because ultimately, you're only an injury away from needing that player.
Yeah, true.
And ultimately, you know, that some people respond like that. And this is probably the more complex thing is everyone's different. Some people respond to that. Some people respond to the pressure. Some people enjoy that pressure.
Mm.
Some people need that pressure to perform. And everyone's different. That's why the relationship bit, even though we call it, you know, it's one word, is very different for different people with different coaches. And that's why it's always a team of coaches, not one coach. And some coaches enjoy people have different relationships with different coaches, which ultimately means different types of conversation, different levels of trust, different influences. And that's why the alignment of all these people factors are so critical in maintaining an output and maintaining someone's development.
That's absolutely fascinating. So do you have a coaching personality in mind that most complements your type of coaching?
I think the modern coach has to be more adaptable, obviously, to work, but, you know, there's no substitute for knowing your players, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, we are, it's all very well talking about players. You have to understand what you're good at too.
Yeah.
And certain players will respond better to that. I think the difficulty is when, for example, I will always look at, everyone says that they want to be the best player they be and they've got a good attitude, and I struggle with players that talk about it but then I don't see action on the back of it.
Yes.
So, you know, I would love to win the lottery, but it requires me to go and buy a ticket. So there has to be some form of behavioural element that comes with it.
Yes.
So if that's not happening, then you almost let them have enough rope to hang themselves, and that gives you the basis for a different conversation. So I know other coaches will act differently to that. But for me, the actions over just words are really important for me. And I struggle potentially with some players that don't do that. So I have to find a different way for those sort of players.
Yeah. Do you think it's possible to teach a player how to prepare? Because it does sound like there's a lot of responsibility on those boys, not just to take the information from you, but then to go and do it. And like, how do you help guide them? Not tell them what to do, but guide them so they do it themselves.
I think you have to help them with processes to allow them to do that. You have to give them skill sets, mental skill sets, as well as physical skill sets to be able to do that. But ultimately, it comes down to building a performance. So, we want the all-court game. Everyone does. Spectators do, fans do, owners do. But what we talk about, the price of entry for a performance, let's start with the building blocks of your performance. So, we need good technical ability. So let's work on the technical ability to give you that confidence. Let's work on the clarity of what's expected to you, whether you're an attack-based player or a defence-based. So, I think what you do is you build cornerstones of your performance and cherish those. And that gives you the stuff to then add the bits around the edges that make, a more impactful performance.
Excellent. So we were previously talking about different types of coaches and like a phase of your career, which absolutely fascinates me. And I guess, it's still linked into what you're doing today, is when you got recruited to Bath, because looking back at it now, that's a little bit of a coaching dream. A coaching dream team. Did it feel like that when you walked through the doors on the first day?
I didn't hear the whole of that question because you broke up a little bit.
Sorry.
Walking through the first bar was interesting because I'd walked into a much more experienced coaching group than I had before.
Mm-hmm.
The expectations of the team from its history was different. Well, I'd worked with Gary before. I'd never worked with Mike. Obviously, Hats. I'd coached Hats and basically given him his coaching breaks in the academy and worked with him and mentored him for a little bit before that. So, a lot of it was familiar. Mm-hmm. What was exciting was the fact that we were in a situation where we felt that the ambition of the owner was exactly the same as the ambition of the coaches. And, that was the exciting part of it.
Did you find that aspect of it daunting? Because obviously Irish are a fine team, but Bath have history and, there's a lot of expectation. There's nowhere to go.
Not really, because obviously when we arrived, they were where they were. And, it takes a lot. You have to undo stuff before you put your own stuff on it. And Bath hadn't been successful for a while, to be fair. So no, we didn't feel the pressure. The greatest pressure we put on it was ourselves, really, because we all came with proven track records, and we wanted to be the best we can as quick as we can, and that would be no different to where we're walking into any club.
So you referred to what you found at Bath when you arrived. So was there almost like a sense of they thought they deserved to be at the top, but I don't know, to coin a phrase, they hadn't paid the price of admission?
No, I just think it was just the start of a different regime. They were changed a lot of players. It was almost like starting again. So no, we didn't think about that side of things. We took it at face value, assessed what we had. And if you look at the change in personnel over the first two or three years, you can see, that was the stepping stones that we required to be a more competitive team.
Yeah, I always do think with Bath, though, that it's difficult on two fronts, and you hear this from players too. One, the expectation, which you've kind of gone over, but also it's such a small place, and, the people in Bath really expect Bath to do very, very well. There's really nowhere to go.
No, that's true. And you see that. But that was part of my motivation for wanting to come here. I wanted to be in the sort of city club or a town club that did care about as much of it as the coaches did. And even though, that can be daunting, and, the postman and the person who works in the toll bridge will have their point of view as you're going in the supermarket, as you're walking around. But that performance pressure, even though it's you know, unpleasant at times when it's not gone your way, that comes with the territory, and you embrace that, and you want to be part of the fabric of the town. So you can't have it both ways. That's why the great thing about Bath from that point of view is, you know, they sell their ground out every week. They've got a lot of passionate people, whether that's misguided, you know, towards coaches or their own opinions, but they're an opinionated bunch. They care about their rugby, they care about their team. And that was, for us, well, certainly for myself, was a very exciting thing to get involved with.
Yeah. Are you often stopped in Bath to ask why player X has been dropped, or, you know, why you chose one line out over another?
Yeah, of course. People always, you know, the one thing that you always get in sport is opinion. And ultimately, you don't justify your opinion. You listen and let people have it. And you know, you're a lot of these, a lot of the fans are very educated in their rugby, and they, you know, you listen to their point of view. But you know, ultimately, we have the idea or the understanding why we've made the decisions we've got, and often those things, you know, are with the best intent that they just want their team to do well. So, you know, you take the rough with the smooth in that point.
Now, I'm going to change conversation completely now, Toby, but how on earth is a guy with your background a Manchester City fan?
I'm a Manchester City fan because of what I said earlier in relation to there was no football around where I lived, not any, you know. I think Hyde Town is the closest, and yeah, I have no idea who they play for these days. And there was no rugby, and there was no real significant sport around it. And it's probably an insight into my personality. When I was sort of 7, 8 years old, I decided, right, okay, I'd like to do things a little differently. For my coaching, you know, I like to innovate as much as I can. I certainly have done that throughout time, less so as much in recent times, but certainly in my London Irish days, we certainly were guilty of doing things differently, lineouts in a swimming pool and bits and pieces like that. and part of all of that is, I just think, right, okay, so the most prestigious competition is the FA Cup. We'll have a look at who was successful around that and the last competition. So I basically picked the team that won the Cup in the year I was born, and that was Man City.
Wow. Of all the years, because I was about to say, you know, how on earth did this happen? Because they weren't even good then. But actually, you managed to find a time when they were good.
Well, to be fair, late 60s and early 70s. So they won their League Cup in 1969, and they beat Leicester City 1-0. Mickey Somerby scored, and I've got the programme. So I've got the courage of my convictions, and that's in the Colin Bell era, etc. And to be fair, my parents were very much into their sport, and they liked that sort of thing. There was a few England players. So actually, in the early part of it, that meant they weren't too bad. It's been a pretty rocky journey after that, and my son, who I've brainwashed, has a much more comfortable journey supporting Man City than I have.
Yeah, I bet. Did you watch last night's game?
I did.
Did you, in fact, with your coaching hat on now, could you feel the momentum of that game shift?
It was more difficult to feel it shift because obviously of the frenetic start, you know, 4 goals in whatever it was, 15 minutes. So I think everyone was playing catch up a little bit. I think that, you know, they paid the price basically for not scoring away from home, and they were always playing catch up. And the one thing that you love about Pep, that he won't change, and he's got the courage of his conviction. His team will always play a certain way. He's learned a little bit. Obviously, he knows that sometimes he can't push all the time. He learned that at Liverpool. It's identical to the Liverpool game at Anfield, where manufactured the situation and got a penalty in both games, and have missed both penalties, and it's cost them dear in both cases.
Yeah, I mean, I thought last night when I was watching it, I only saw the second half. And I have a sort of rule when I'm watching rugby, okay, just to bring it back to rugby a bit, but if a team is absolutely dominant for, say, 10, 15 minutes but gets no points or gets no reward from it, I often think that team is then destined to lose because there's nothing worse than being dominant and not getting
ebb and
anything.
Flow. Yeah. Yeah, it's the ebb and flow. Very rarely do you get it all your way, especially when you're, you know, at the elite level and what you're dealing with. It's really tough. So, yeah, you basically got to, you know, you've got to convert when you've got all the pressure.
Yeah, I just thought I've seen this far too many times before. As long as the other team's got a chance and you're doing that well, you're usually in trouble.
Yeah, because the disparity's never normally that much. Sure.
Now, when you look over at football, they obviously don't have a salary cap. In my mind, this means it's a little bit easier to coach them because anyone can assemble the best players on earth for enough money. So two questions on that one. One, how does the salary cap affect the quality of our coaching? And also then, how do you go about selecting players to fit into, you know, that cap?
There's a couple of how long is a piece of string questions there.
There are, aren't there?
I actually think it's more complex for a coach rather than simple. More simple, as you mentioned it. I think it's because you can't get it wrong. You have to be very more aware and definite on the sort of players that are going to have the greatest influence on the way that you want to play. So you need to recruit to a style even more so.
Okay.
So I think that the skill about getting those right players are even more pressurized. Rather than moulding a style to a team, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You basically set the philosophy of your team and recruit and develop to it. And I think that because of the wage cap, it's a team A might need certain type of players A and B, and without them, you're not going to function.
Yeah.
And, you know, that I think you need to be very definite on the type of players that align to your playing philosophy, for one. So that was the first question. And what was the second question?
Well, I think you've answered it. I think you've answered it perfectly, actually, which is, how do you go about selecting players in a salary cap situation? And, you've got to be very, very careful, I guess.
Yeah. And I also think if you look at the success, the consistent successes in recent times, so your Exeters and Saracens, you know, they probably teams that have worked that out better than other teams, and they've developed and done exactly that.
Now, I'm only going to ask you a couple more questions and then I'll let you get on with undoubtedly what is a beautiful day in Bath.
It is, yeah.
But you mentioned innovations. Which innovation are you most proud of? Oh, actually, as soon as you mentioned that, I seem to remember a story in the back of my head. Did you make your players dive through a paddling pool in order to get them, get them used to wet weather training?
Yeah. Wet weather training. Yeah, that's on YouTube still. A day in the life of London Irish.
Oh, is it?
So that's probably a good example. That's the most visible. It's So we knew that there's wet weather, and obviously you've got to try and maintain motivation.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see Peter Hewitt in his speedos jumping in and out the pool. But yeah, so basically we basically had a glorified water fight and dunking session, and we then went and played plays, then we'd go back in the water, etc. And it was really just to emphasise the ability that maybe in conditions like this, how important it is to play. We were very much a counter-attack-based side, that we needed to be respectful of field position and the difficulty that the conditions have in your skill set. So sometimes it's not innovation, sometimes it's just an awareness, to drive awareness and look at solving a problem or driving awareness in a different way.
Have you ever tried something which has just been a miserable failure?
Oh, for sure.
Go on.
Absolutely, for sure. And in relation to, I'll think of a specific example, but, that's part of, we talk about people maximise their talent, and often people talk about the performers in the ring, as it were. But coaching is no different. You've got to keep trying to push the boundary, push it, the efficiency, and probably where the innovation's gone out of the game, because so many more are students of the game. It's more around efficiency than innovation, but these things go full circle. The game's quite sterile in relation to the systems people are using. So I think it's probably due another innovation at some point. And the ones that can master that will probably, catch a few people by surprise.
Okay, Toby, business time now. Where are Bath going to finish this year? And then finish off with where we can find you on social media.
Okay, so obviously we're still, despite our inconsistencies this year, we're still in the final shake-up for the top four. So you know, those results will probably need a few to go our way, but we're playing people around us. So, you know, we're still ambitious to finish, you know, in that top four position. If not there, then very close to it. So that's as far as I'll go from a prediction point of view. In relation to finding me, if anybody wants to find me, I'm on Twitter, and not many coaches are, but I'm on Twitter, and Boothie06 is where you can find me.
Excellent. Well, you've got Sale Sharks next. I'll be at the AJ Bell, so I look forward to catching up with you there.
Come and say hello. You're good to see you.
No problem. Toby, thank you so much for coming on, and best of luck with the rest of the season.
Cheers, mate. Speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.